This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, so what we're going to do is, as you can imagine, quite ridiculous. We're going to cover 900 years of Polish Jewish history in the space of less than an hour. Has anybody here ever seen the complete abridged works of William Shakespeare? This is a fantastic off-Broadway show that if you're ever someplace where it's happening, I very much suggest you go. It's like four lines from Macbeth, two lines from Hamlet, a line from Othello. It's hilarious. It's absolutely hilarious. I won't be as funny as they are, but this is as absurd. But I do think there is a value in doing what we're going to do, because what we are essentially going to do is look at the big picture, look at the big themes, so that as we prepare and as we travel in Poland, hopefully things will fit into a framework. Before I get to actually move into, you know what, they stop me at 2:25 and I'll have 2 minutes to say of more technical things, okay? So let's go right into the material. So you all have these sheets. Everybody has a sheet? Okay, Doug, we have an extra sheet. Good. So please pass to Doug. Okay. So the first question is, how did Jews get to Poland? How did Jews come to Poland to begin with? They were pushed out of Europe, you're saying. What does that mean, pushed out of Europe?
They were Jews in Poland before.
Well, we really don't know when Jews first came to Poland. We have some evidence there were Jews there as early as 900. But for the most part, where do most Polish Jews actually come from? Not, well, say this again. Say that again. Chazar, meaning Khazar, Khazar, the Khazar kingdom. Okay, so let's talk about that for a moment. Let's talk. Right. We're going to look at a map of Central Europe, which of you? Yes, this is the UK, and this is France. These are all drawn exactly to scale, as you can see. And Spain, and this is Germany. Remember, Germany was not a state until 1871. It was many different states, but German states. And this is Poland. And this is Russia. Okay, so they have a perfectly drawn map of Europe. Now, in southern Russia, not far from the Black Sea, there were a group of people called Khazars, the Khazar kingdom. What?
A little
north of Turkey. Absolutely.
They were by the Black Sea.
The Black Sea. The Black Sea. The Khazar kingdom is an interesting kingdom of which we don't know too much. We do know that sometime in the 8th century, the king of the Khazars and probably most of his noblemen converted to Judaism. Now, this sounds like a tall tale, but it actually is true. It's a crazy story. And probably their conversion to Judaism was a statement of neutrality between the warring Christian and Muslim worlds. Actually, I think it was the 9th century. But it was probably due to that, and they wanted to call themselves neutral, and so they, as most pagan societies were converting at this time. The Irish are converting to Catholicism at this time. Much of Europe is converting. So they convert to a monotheistic religion. They choose Judaism. Now, it's really a fascinating story. We know they corresponded with Jews in Spain. The Khazars disappear, as far as we know from history. They're conquered by the Tatars, probably around 1200, something like that, 1100. That's it. We really don't know much about the Khazars. There was actually a TV documentary on Israeli TV about a decade ago, in which a very prominent Israeli journalist, Ehud Ya'ari, who says his family has a tradition, they are descendants of Khazars, actually went to the area and found some ruins. He didn't really discover anything very new, but it was a very interesting documentary. The Khazar kingdom probably became most famous in Jewish life because Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in the 11th century, decides to write a book, and here I've given you the sheets, you have it in front of you, called the Khuzari, which is a work of philosophy. You know, in the medieval period, I think you know that oftentimes Christians, Muslims, and Jews were in conversation, in debate, often trying to prove that their religion was the true religion. And Yehuda Halevi, a great poet, also wrote this philosophical work trying to prove that Judaism was the true religion. And how did he do that? By using the example of the Khazars. In other words, they could have converted to Christianity, they could have converted to Islam, they chose Judaism. Why? It is not an historical work. It is not meant to be an historical work. He just places it there because it's a good setting for him to make his case. Okay? So that book, HaKuzari, is a very important work of Jewish philosophy, medieval Jewish philosophy, and probably that's the way many people have heard of the Khazar kingdom. So there is a 20th century writer by the name of Arthur Koestler. Arthur Koestler wrote a book called The 13th Tribe. Arthur Koestler, by the way, is not an historian, but very important European intellectual. And Arthur Koestler maintains that these Khazars are the origin of most Polish Jews. Now, the vast majority of historians disagree. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen one that agrees with him. And we'll talk about why in a moment. There's another theory that's a little more fanciful even than Arthur Koestler. And that is that Polish Jews were actually came from Jews who were wandering through Europe. And as they wandered, they came to Poland, and a note came down from heaven. And the note said, Po-lin. Here, stay. Here, rest. And that's how the Jews came to Poland. By the way, when we go to the new museum in Warsaw, Igor has seen it already. He's been to the Museum of the History of Polish Jews, which is really an outstanding museum, won the award as the best museum in Europe for 2015, I think it was. That's how it starts. It starts with that story, that legend of how the Jews came to Poland. Because that was a legend that was current among many Polish Jews. The reality, according to the vast majority of historians, if not all, is that Polish Jews actually are, from the vast majority of them, from Germany. Now that I've told you that, tell me why you think that makes sense. First of all, they're Ashkenazim. They're Ashkenazim who follow the Ashkenazic traditions for the most part of Ashkenazic Jewry in Germany. There are some slight differences between Nusach Ashkenaz and Nusach Polin, but for the most part, it's Ashkenazic. As opposed to the Khazars, who were Sephardic. They wrote to Spain in order to ask questions about Jewish law, and they followed Sephardic ritual. So that's one way in which we can say that it makes sense. Any other ways in which it makes sense?
Yiddish.
What's the language of Polish Jews? It's essentially medieval German with some Slavic and Hebrew elements. So linguistically, there's a very clear connection between Germany and Polish Jews. Okay? I've been to Germany a few times. And my Yiddish is good enough that I can understand a lot, and my English is good enough that I can understand most of what people are saying. Well, let's say I can understand enough of what people are saying. When I open my mouth and speak in Yiddish to a German, They usually understand me, but they think that I'm speaking the strangest dialect of German they've ever heard. Because it's like speaking Chaucer's English. Chaucer's English. Geoffrey Chaucer is a medieval English writer. Right? So, the Canterbury Tales, if you've heard of them, okay? So, Yiddish is, more than anything else, medieval German, okay? So these are two very important factors, or if you like, proofs, that the Jews of Poland come from Germany. We also have many historical documents that document it, and we also have the geographic proximity, and on top of all of that, we also know that Polish Jewry begins to grow in population precisely when German Jews are leaving Germany in large numbers. Okay? So, yes, you have to hand
up. Has there been like, genetic testing done to compare?
Genetic testing, you know, there was an article about genetic testing of Ashkenazic Jews in the New York Times a few years ago, and somebody can Google that, but I don't think that it dealt with the question of Germany and Poland. In fact, I think what it dealt with was the first Ashkenazic Jews who came to Germany from Italy, which is a few centuries before. I think that's what the focus of that research was about. Okay, so they come from Germany. Okay, so now we have to try to figure out what was pushing them out of Germany and what was pulling them Davka to Poland. Okay, so any thoughts here? Probably
religious persecution.
Religious persecution. Remember the First Crusade. And I refer again to the sheet. The First Crusade begins in 1096, and in the First Crusade, there are massacres of Jews along the Rhine River. There are also forced conversions of Jews, but perhaps most importantly, it's in the aftermath of the First Crusade that anti-Semitism grows more virulent in Germany and in Europe as a whole. Okay? So, for example, things like the blood libel. What is the blood libel? Jews murder a Christian baby in order to use the blood for the baking of matzot or for some other black magical purpose. That blood idea of a blood libel begins in Europe, actually in England, William of Norwich, only after the First Crusade. The same thing for the charge of desecrating the host. Anybody know what that is, desecrating the host?
Yes.
What's desecrating the host?
It's kind of the Christian host used in their ceremonial mass.
Taking the knife and put it in
the wafer, right? Using the wafer, which represents Jesus' body in the Catholic Mass, and that the Jews did some kind of voodoo on it, stabbing it many times in order to reenact the crucifixion. And, you know, even though these things sound ridiculous, many Jewish communities, many Jewish individuals suffered arrest, torture, death, expulsion, confiscation of property as a result of these things over the centuries. Those two charges only begin in Europe after the First Crusade. Okay? Because the First Crusade is a turning point in the history of anti-Semitism. And from that point on, anti-Semitism grows much more virulent. Ailey.
Also, there's the Black Death and the poisoning
of the wells.
Of the wells. And
absolutely.
I would say that this, until then, one should speak more about anti-Judaism than about anti-Semitism as we know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, I mean, you're aware of this, just as a remark. And anti-Semitic or anti-Judaic agitators like the Knights Rindfleisch and Armlehrer and all these things were mainly motivated by popular average Christian. It's not really Christian because it doesn't come from high religious authorities, with the exception of Martin Luther and others, maybe, but it's more anti-Judaic.
Okay, so we have a series of persecutions of Jews, in particular the Rindfleisch massacres the Black Death of 1348, which the Jews are blamed for poisoning the wells in Europe. And then there are a series of expulsions of Jews from German cities and towns. Okay? So this is some of the push. Okay? Why Jews are leaving Germany. Now, what's the pull? What's pulling Jews towards Poland? Yeah, Donnie?
Is Poland a unified kingdom yet at this point?
Yes, yes. Poland is a unified kingdom. In fact, they will unify together with Lithuania beginning in the 1500s, I think, till the 1700s. There will be a union of Poland and Lithuania as well. Okay?
So if it's a unified kingdom, maybe there's something in it feeling more stable and less sort of attuned to, like, whims of particular Jewish rulers all over the place.
Okay. What are the pull factors, Nati?
There's vacancy of Jews. I mean, there's no Jews in Poland.
No. First of all, there are some Jews in Poland, but it's a small community. Okay? But why Davka Poland? There are no Jews in the Arctic Circle. Yes.
If it's a United Kingdom at this time, wasn't there something written in the charter to protect Jews?
So there are two Polish kings listed on your sheet, Boleslav the Pious and Casimir the Great, who literally invite the Jews to Poland. One in 1264, the other reiterates it in 1344. And this is precisely when Jewish population begins to take off in Poland. And they promise the Jews protection. And they promise the Jews certain what they call privileges, what we would call rights. For example, the privilege to buy land for a Jewish cemetery. The privilege to build a synagogue. And also, perhaps most importantly for Jews at the time, autonomy. Autonomy. The Jews could rule themselves. Autonomy was the rule in the medieval world for Jewish communities, both in Ashkenaz as well as in Sephardic communities. And this is because medieval society was a corporate society. It wasn't only the Jews who had autonomy. There were corporate entities that had autonomy as well. For example, the guilds. The guilds were autonomous in Europe. And as an autonomous group, they decided the rules of their own guild. They decided the prices that would be charged. They decided what the training period would be for apprenticeships. They decided what kind of work would be done. The example I always like to give is the Guild of the Barbers in Seville, in Spain. That guild determined what kind of haircuts would be given. And they determined how much it would cost for a haircut. And the king had no power over them. He could not dictate to them to change their prices, or to change hairstyles, or to change the rules of apprenticeships. They had autonomy. Similarly, the clergy, the Catholic clergy, had autonomy in Europe. They had their own court system. They couldn't be taxed. And the nobility had autonomy too. They also could not be taxed. That's how the French Revolution started. As King Louis XVI wanted to get the Estates General to tax the nobility because he had a financial crisis. He needed to get a body together in order to undo the autonomy that existed for centuries and the tax exemption the nobility had for centuries. The Jews, too, had autonomy. They ruled themselves. They had their own law courts, Bate Din. They had their own laws, Halacha. They chose their own leaders. When taxes needed to be paid, the Jewish community paid the taxes as a community, not as individuals, in general, in medieval Europe. Sort of like a kibbutz. like the kibbutz used to be.
That you still pay collective
taxes. Oh, yes? Okay. Okay. So that autonomy was a very important feature of Jewish life all over the medieval world, and the Polish kings tell the Jews they will have autonomy there as well. In fact, the autonomy the Jews achieved in Poland perhaps exceeded the autonomy Jews had anywhere else, because they organized themselves not only as local communities, meaning the Jews of Krakow, the Jews of Lublin, the Jews of Lvov, but they organized a national body called the Va'ad Arba'a Aratzot, the Council of the Four Lands, which was like a Jewish national congress with representatives from all the communities, or at least from the most important communities. And they would meet every year, once or twice a year. We actually have the minutes of the meetings of the Va'ad Arba'a Aratzot over a period of more than a century. But that kind of national congress is very hard to find anywhere else in the Jewish world, but you find it in Poland. This Va'ad Arba'a Aratzot often met in Lublin, where we will be visiting. They usually met either right before or right after a major trade fair. Because who were the representatives who went to the Va'ad Arba'a Aratzot? The leadership of the Jewish community. What's the leadership of the Jewish community? Take a wild guess. The wealthy merchants and the rabbis. Okay? So the wealthy merchants would be coming to the fair anyway. So they'd say, okay, there's a fair in Lublin. It'll take place in the spring. That's our next meeting of the Va'ad Arba'a Aratzot. Okay? Yes, the Va'ad Arba'a Aratzot appointed a shtadlan to the Polish court, meaning a lobbyist. Lehishtadel is to try, to attempt. Okay? The shtadlan was somebody who was at the Polish court trying to promote Jewish interests with the Polish monarchy. And he was assigned there by the Va'ad Arba'a Aratzot. Okay, it was the Jewish lobbyist at court. Okay? Yes, Ailey.
I want to add that, we can all guess that the Jewish monarchs did not give this just like, oh, because we are so enlightened and we want the Jews to come. So that the Jews, they were smart and saw the opportunity that the Jews could fill the space they badly needed, because Poland more than a central Europe, like France and Germany, for instance, had a lack of middle class, let's say, modern, we would call it a middle class merchant. It was highly agricultural based system with a very strong aristocracies and a huge gap between them. So I think they were very smart, and this is the main reason why they.
Absolutely. Thank you for making that point. It wasn't a humanitarian gesture. It was in line with many other invitations that Jews received from kings, from princes, from bishops sometimes in a city, inviting Jews to come because they thought the Jews would bring economic prosperity because they were generally literate and had commercial connections. And that was the reason that they were invited to many of these places. You know, that idea of the Jews and finance somehow is a very old idea. Of course, today we know much better than that. You know, that's why in America the heads of the Federal Reserve Board have been exactly in proportion to the Jewish population in America. About 2% of the heads of the Federal Reserve Board have been Jewish. Oh, wait a minute. Actually, the last three or four have all been Jewish. And what about secretaries of the Treasury? I think the last two or three have all been Jewish. So it's not only a medieval perception. It may be a little bit different today, but actually it's remarkable how this idea of Jews being smart with money, etc., is something that persists in the
it's
world today.
It's not only about money, it's also about little craftsmanship.
Yes, absolutely. And
like
by the way...
Merchants, like little shopkeepers.
Absolutely. It's very, very true. It's not only the big merchants, because most Jews were not big merchants. If you want to invite just the big merchants, you don't have to invite the whole Jewish community. So you're absolutely right. The Jews are mostly engaged in small shopkeeping and in crafts, and those things were needed. And... Ailey, I'm glad you mentioned what you said, because the Poles don't only invite Jews, they invite Germans. In other words, the Jews are part of a general migration from Germany to Poland, where there are economic opportunities not only for the middle class, but also land is more readily available. And so we have, in Poland, not only a Jewish minority, and we'll see a Ukrainian-Lithuanian minority, we also have a German minority, what are called the Volksdeutsche later, and we'll refer to them when we come into the 20th century, not today, but when we're in Poland. The Volksdeutsche were Polish citizens who had German ancestry. Okay? Okay. Okay, you see on the sheet, 1648, we estimate about 500,000 Jews living in Poland, definitely the largest Jewish community in the world at the time. Remember, population figures at those times were much, much less than today. 500,000 was an enormous Jewish community to exist at that time. Now, one thing that I haven't mentioned yet, which is important for us to know, is that the area of southern Russia bordering on Poland is known as the Ukraine. The Ukraine. The Ukraine was controlled by Poland for centuries. And the Ukraine, by the way, is bigger than France. So if we're talking about 1600, for example, Poland is the largest country in all of Europe. Poland is a major European power. When the Turks are going to advance on Vienna, it's the Polish army that's going to turn them back. Okay?
That's in 1648.
And it's not 1648, but it's either in the 1500s or early 1600s. Forgetting the name of the battle, but near Vienna. It was the Polish army who turned back the Ottoman Turks. So, you know, contrary to our perceptions of Poland, you know, today, Poland was a major, major power. Okay? Okay. Questions up to this point? Okay, so, as the Polish Jewish population grows and prospers, they establish their own yeshivot. Up until the 1500s, 1518 exactly, if you had a young, aspiring Talmid Chacham in Poland, you sent him to yeshiva where? In Germany. In Germany. The yeshivot along the Rhine River. Worm, Speyer, where Rashi studied. Okay? But beginning in 1518, once they've achieved a certain critical mass of people and a certain level of prosperity, they begin to establish their own yeshivot. And the first yeshiva that they establish is indeed in Lublin. And it was established by Rav Shalom Shachna, Rav Yaakov Palak, who was succeeded by Rav Shalom Shachna as the Rosh Yeshiva. Now, Rav Shalom Shachna is not as famous as two of his Talmidim, two of his students. And those two are Rav Moshe Isserles, the Rama, and the Maharshal. These are two of the Gedolim, these are two of the most important rabbis of the 16th century in the Jewish world. The Rama is from Krakow. He goes to Lublin, to yeshiva, to learn with Rav Shalom Shachna. When he finishes his learning, he goes back to Krakow. And we will visit his grave and his shul as well, the shul that his father built for him, which is still standing. Hopefully we'll even daven in his shul.
His father built him a shul.
His father was a wealthy merchant in Krakow.
It's like his
The Maharshal was from Lublin. I'm not sure he was actually from Lublin, but after he studied, finished studying in Lublin, he succeeded Rav Shalom Shachna as the Rosh Yeshiva in Lublin. And for those who study Gemara, if you look in the back of the Vilna edition, you'll see the commentary called the Yamshel Shlomo. That is the commentary of the Maharshal. The Rama is most famous for? What? Hagot? Yeah. Exactly. the Ashkenazic commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, which was written by Rav Yosef Karo, who's Sfaradi, is the Ramah. The Ramah becomes essentially the most important halachic decisor in the Ashkenazic world. Okay? From the Shulchan Aruch on, I would say he becomes the most important decisor in the Ashkenazic world. And if not the most important, one of the most important. The period we're talking about, the 1500s and the early 1600s, is actually considered to be the golden age of the Jews of Poland. Because along with the establishment of yeshivot, because the Ramah will establish a yeshiva in his shul in Krakow, there's also stability, prosperity, protection from the kings. It's a golden age for Poland and a golden age for Polish Jews. And some of the figures, some of the leading rabbis of this golden age are the Maharsha in Lublin, another one who writes a very important commentary on the Gemara, and buried in Krakow along with the Ramah is the Bach, the Bayit Chadash, Rav Yoel Sirkis, the Megale Amukot, and the Tosfot Yom Tov, or Yom Tov Lipman Heller, all buried in the same cemetery in Krakow, and we'll visit some of their graves when we're there and talk a little bit more about them. This golden age comes to a crashing halt in 1648 with the beginning of a peasants' uprising in the Ukraine, led by a man named Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Bogdan Khmelnytsky is a leader of the Cossacks in the Ukraine, and they essentially rebel for socioeconomic, religious, and national reasons. Poland, we said, controlled the Ukraine. There were vast estates in the Ukraine controlled by Polish landlords. If you've studied Irish history at all, very similar to British estates in Ireland. Okay? Was the absentee landlord kind of thing. And the Ukrainians speak a different language, Ukrainian, worship differently, the Ukrainian Orthodox as opposed to Polish Roman Catholic. They were generally the peasants, they were poor, and the Poles were the overlords, you know, the nobility. And so the Ukrainian uprising is a peasants' revolt, but at the same time a national and religious revolt as well against the Poles. Caught in the middle of this are the Jews. Because the Jews oftentimes acted as the managers of the absentee Polish landlords' estates. And as the managers of the estates, it was their job to collect taxes, to make sure that the peasants fulfill their obligations to the landlords, etc. And so on top of general xenophobia and general anti-Semitism that may have just existed in the Ukraine, you now have this dynamic of this peasant revolt, which is aimed not only at the Polish nobility, but at the Jews who are working for the Polish nobility in the Ukraine. This revolt is particularly violent. One Jewish chronicler at the time writes that he estimates 100,000 Jews are murdered during the Khmelnytsky revolt. We don't know if that number is correct. What it tells us is a lot of Polish Jews lose their lives. Not only that, but in a more general sense, the Polish monarchy is never the same after the Khmelnytsky revolt. Because in the aftermath of the Khmelnytsky revolt, with the Polish monarchy weakened, Sweden invades Poland, Russia invades Poland, Turkey invades Poland, everybody senses Poland's weakness. On top of that, the Polish monarchy becomes much weaker. And as a result, the position of the Jews in Poland is going to deteriorate. Right? The condition in general in Poland is going to deteriorate, and the position for the Jews in Poland is going to deteriorate as well. It it's against this background that we can see the Shabtai Tzvi movement of 1666, where Shabtai Tzvi declares himself the Messiah. And some historians believe the majority of the world's Jews actually believed him and followed him. He had a very large following, that's for sure, but some maintain even a majority of the world's Jews. And certainly in Poland there were followers of Shabtai Tzvi.
Did he ever visit Poland?
I don't think he ever visited Poland. What happens to Shabtai Tzvi? He converts to Islam. Okay? It's a terribly demoralizing impact on Jews all over the world. The person they thought was going to redeem them instead converts to Islam. Some follow him into Islam. And some just feel broken. You know, there are books published in Amsterdam at the time that have on the frontispiece published in the first year or the second year of our Mashiach. And there were Jews who literally sold all their belongings, getting ready to move to Eretz Yisrael. The Shabtai Tzvi movement was the largest false messianic movement in Jewish history. Some could argue Christianity might be, but I won't get into that. Okay? Some would argue today Chabad might be, but I won't get into that either. Okay? But it was the largest false messianic movement, and it left the Jewish people very demoralized afterwards. On top of that, in Poland, in the early 1700s, there was a character by the name of Jacob Frank. Jacob Frank proclaimed himself to be the reincarnation of Shabtai Tzvi. And he had followers in Poland. He ultimately converted to Catholicism.
Maybe he wasn't lying.
What? Yeah. He actually had a very interesting take on what Jewish life should be. He organized mass orgies.
With tzitzit and
tefillin. I mean, he was really, really a character. So that, all of this of what I'm telling you tells us something about the condition of Polish Jews in the 1700s, and it's against this backdrop that there appears in the Ukraine, in Mezhebuzh, which is still controlled by Poland, a man by the name of Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. Yisrael was his name, Rabbi Yisrael, and people gave him the name Baal Shem Tov. A Baal Shem in those days was a healer. And he was considered such a great healer that he was called the Baal Shem Tov. Okay? And the Baal Shem Tov begins to preach in the Ukraine with certain emphases on certain things in Jewish life that were less emphasized before. And there's a very big historical debate between two professors here in Yerushalayim, Professor Emanuel Etkis at the Hebrew University, whom I studied with, and Professor Moshe Rossman, who lives in the Dan complex, a neighbor and friend of mine, about the nature of early Hasidut. According to the traditional view, which Professor Emanuel Etkis has, Hasidut was a reaction by the poor to the terrible conditions existed after the Khmelnytsky revolt, the Shabtai Tzvi movement, the Jacob Frank movement, and the poor people gravitated towards him. It was mostly illiterate people who were not well educated, because the educational system starts to break down as there isn't the same prosperity as there was before, and so people begin to flock to this new movement. According to Professor Moshe Rossman, who had access to documents after the fall of communism in the Ukraine and in Poland, and knows Polish very well, this idea is not totally correct. In fact, he says, the people who initially followed the Baal Shem Tov were quite well-to-do and quite literate. And not only that, but the Baal Shem Tov's ideas actually are similar to the ideas of Hasidut Ashkenaz of the medieval period. A few hundred years before, there was a group of pietists who called themselves Hasidei Ashkenaz, and that actually is the germ of the new movement that calls itself Hasidut. So, who's correct, who's not correct, I don't want to say. I don't know. I think there probably is some truth to both of them. The Hasidic movement spreads like wildfire. From the time the Baal Shem Tov starts teaching, he goes into a period of hibernation, and he appears in 1740 with his doctrines. In those 20 years, from 1740 to 1760, he gathers around him numerous disciples. He's succeeded by the Magid of Meserich, Rav Dov Ber. And Rav Dov Ber, the Magid of Meserich, then takes his students and sends them to different parts of mostly Eastern Europe to spread the ideas of Hasidut. And the disciple of the Magid of Meserich, who goes from the Ukraine to Poland, is Rav Elimelech of Lizhansk. Rav Elimelech and his brother, Reb Zusha of Anapol, are sent to Poland to spread the ideas of Hasidut to Poland. And they are extremely successful. So much so that by the 1800s, by the late 1800s certainly, probably the middle as well, the majority of religious Jews in Poland are Hasidim, or followers of this new doctrine. Those of you who are studying Hasidut with Levi Cooper know something about Hasidut. We'll talk more about Hasidut when we're in Poland. But this new ideology becomes the prevalent religious ideology among the Jews of Poland by the mid to late 19th century. Yes?
Did the Hasidut ever take hold in Lithuania and Vilna, or did the Gaons, Litvak, Mitnagid way kind of hold sway?
Good, good. Thank you for asking your question. Because Barry's question brings us to the opposition to this new movement, which was centered around the figure of the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, Gaon Rabbi Eliyahu. The Vilna Gaon, who is a towering figure in 18th century Jewish life. In the course that I took with Professor Manuel Etkes at Hebrew University many years ago, Professor Manuel Etkes is not a religious person, or let's say he doesn't wear a kippah. I don't want to judge his spiritual state, but he doesn't present as a religious person. And he was describing the Vilna Gaon, and he said that one of the biographers of the Vilna Gaon said that he never slept more than, I think it was, 3 hours a night, and never more than 1 hour at a time. He went through Shas completely, I think, every month. He would put his feet in freezing water in order to stay awake at night to learn. He is the model of Torah learning, not only in his generation, but for what we call today Lithuanian Haredim today as well. The Vilna Gaon actually excommunicates the Baal Shem Tov and his followers twice, not once. And by the way, what does it tell you when a law is promulgated twice? The first one didn't work. That's what it tells us. They were excommunicated twice. And the reason they were excommunicated, I think, has to do not only with their ideology, which in the eyes of the Lithuanian yeshivot downgraded the place of Torah learning and replaced it with other things as a means to coming closer to God. But also, we have to see it against the backdrop of the Shabtai Tzvi movement and the Jacob Frank movement. They felt that Hasidut, which had an emphasis on messianic ideas, was going to become another false messianic movement. And so in addition to the ideological differences, which were real, there was also this fear that this new movement, too, would lead Jews astray and into another religion.
which makes sense why Shabtai Tzvi and Frank weren't excommunicated, because they weren't on the backdrop of anything, I guess.
Oh, I think Jacob Frank was excommunicated. I think he was. But Shabtai Tzvi... Yeah, Shabtai Tzvi, look, there was a great controversy about Shabtai Tzvi. Not everybody accepted him, but he was widely accepted. Okay, so this is Hasidut. Now, at the same time, as Hasidut is spreading in Poland, from Rav Elimelech of Lizhansk and his brother Rav Zusha, Rav Elimelech, by the way, will visit his grave, and we'll hopefully have a tish there as well, because that's the custom, is that you come to the grave and you actually celebrate his life. And so we'll hopefully have a tish there, and we'll get to drink some Polish vodka. But it's during the late 1700s that Poland is actually partitioned between Prussia, Austria, and Russia, right? And it's partitioned three times, as you can see here, 1772, 1793, and in 1795, basically those three powers say, what the heck, and they get rid of Poland altogether. So there's no Poland on the map from 1795 to 1918. There are Polish people, they're speaking Polish, they view themselves as Poles, there is no country called Poland from 1795 to 1918. It means that when we discuss Polish Jewry during this time period, we're actually talking about Jews living in Russia, Prussia, and Austria. Okay? And that's a very important thing to keep in mind, because they're going to be developing in different ways. Because this is also the time of emancipation, 1795 to 1918. The Jews of Prussia are going to be emancipated in the 1800s, the Jews of Austria in 1867. By then it's called Austria-Hungary. The Jews of Russia only in 1917. They will have a very different experience. It's also the time of the growth of the Haskalah. The Haskalah, the enlightenment among the Jews, meaning the introduction of secular language and literature to Jews, is growing at this time. And this will be one of the reasons why the Hasidic movement and the Misnagdim, their opponents, are going to reconcile more or less. Of course, they both see a greater threat to Jewish life than the other, and that is the Haskalah, which is leading some Jews away from religious observance.
So, you said that during this time there's no state of
Poland. Correct.
That Poles sort of had a sense of national Polish identity.
Yes.
Do Jews have a sense of Polish-Jewish identity?
It depends. Mm-hmm. Some did. In fact, as we'll discuss when we go to Poland, there were Polish revolts against Russia in the 1800s, around 1830 and in 1863. And there were Polish-Jewish rabbis who actually urged the Jews to join the revolt. And there are streets named after them in Poland. Both in Warsaw and in Krakow, there's a Ulica Meisels, named after Rabbi Dov Ber Meisels, who was a leading Polish rabbi who encouraged Jews to join the revolt against the Russians, and many did. Okay? However, there are other Jews who are already identifying as Austrians, or as Prussians, or even as Russians. Yes.
And so when we hear the term the Pale,
yes,
so it's just the Russian partition.
Exactly. The Pale is Eastern Poland. I want to be accurate. See how accurate I'm being. So, okay, because actually Austria controls all of this.
Didn't even that change, though? There were times when Prussia controlled parts of the Pale. Not really.
They called it the Pale of Settlement, and for a while Jews could only live in that Pale of Settlement, and there was certain legislation that applied to the Jews there from the Tsarist regime. This area that's going to be controlled by Austria, basically southern Poland, is what is called Galicia. Who here is a Galiciana? Raise your hand. Oh, there must be more Galicianus than that. There must be. Right? So this was a very heavily Jewishly populated area, southern Poland, and it was known as Galicia. And the definition of Galicia is the area of Poland controlled by Austria or Austria-Hungary after the partition.
So is it? Maybe I'm not good. Is it Kalinice? Is it next to? Is it? No, it's too central.
I don't know that location. Say it again.
No, it's next to Lodz.
Oh no! So that's not Galicia.
Yeah,
that's not Galicia. Galicia, basically, the capital of Western Galicia is Krakow, and the capital of Eastern Galicia is Lviv, or Lemberg, or as it's called today in Ukrainian, Lviv. Okay. Yes.
My great grandmother was Romanian, and when she actually eloped with her husband, because when she told her parents that she wanted to marry a Galician, they were like, Galiciana, they're horse thieves. Apparently, they had a bad reputation as stealing horses.
Yes, the Litvaks and the Galicianas have a very long-standing rivalry. And it certain ways parallels the Hasidic Misnagdic rivalry, but it goes beyond that as well. Yes, also their Yiddish is different. The Yiddish of the Lithuanian Jews is slightly different than the Yiddish of Galician Jews. Okay, 19th century. The 19th century includes the growth of European nationalism in general, and the beginnings of Zionism as well, in these areas, in what I'll call Poland, even though there was no Polish state. It's also 19th century. The Industrial Revolution also brings about the rise of socialism. And Jewish socialism grows not only because Jews join socialist parties, particularly in Eastern Europe, but they form their own Jewish socialist party called the Bund. And we'll talk more about the Bund when we get to Poland. And at the same time, in reaction to the Haskalah and the beginnings of modernization and movement away from traditional observance, a new organization is founded called Agudat Yisrael. The Aguda, basically the forerunner of the Haredi political party in Israel, is founded in 1912 in Poland by the Gera Rebbe and by the Chafetz Chaim. And we'll talk more about Agudat Yisrael, which played a very important role in Polish Jewish life, because we're only getting up to 1918. 1918, look at your sheet, the end of World War I. Poland is reconstituted as a state. Remember Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, national self-determination. Empires are broken up, small countries are created. Poland is now reconstituted. It's 10% Jewish. Now, 10% may not sound like a lot, but it's enormous. There was no country in the diaspora that came close to Poland in terms of the concentration of Jews. Lithuania was second with 7.6, I believe, at this time. I don't have an immediate answer for you, Ari. My guess is it was less, but probably not too much less. And you could see the cities of Poland were heavily Jewish, far beyond the 10%. When I talk about, let's say, the most Jewish city in the diaspora is, of course, New York, which the anti-Semites like to call Jew York. At its height, before the flight to the suburbs, it was 28% Jewish. The most Jewish city in the diaspora. And now take a look. These cities were more Jewish than New York. Okay?
Do you know what percentage of Odessa was?
Odessa, I don't have. Odessa was in Russia, I don't have it offhand. Less than this. But Odessa was also heavily Jewish. Okay. So, I want to remind everybody of a couple of technical things. Number one, everybody needs to do some family research. You need to speak to a grandparent, a great aunt, a great uncle, your parents, somebody who might know something, or start to do some genealogical research on your own. This is, first of all, a good thing to do for you. Secondly, it is important, because I'm going to ask all of you to make a 5-minute presentation about your family roots. It might have nothing to do with the Holocaust. It might have nothing to do with Poland. But nonetheless, if we each present for 5 minutes about our family history, it will actually give us a big picture of what was happening in the Jewish world, and it'll be valuable for all of us. It's also a good way for us to get to know each other a little bit better.
Something we'll do on the trip?
On the trip, we're going to do it. And you might even discover you have a Landsman. You know what a Landsman is?
Same area.
That's right. You might discover you have somebody from your ancestral home. Okay? In the process, if you discover a particular place that's connected to your family history, let me know. Okay? I can't guarantee it, but we might be able to visit there if you have an address, even better.
Do you have an itinerary? Like,
yes. We sent out the itinerary, didn't we? Sent out a sample itinerary. We've changed it a little bit, but basically it's pretty much the same. Okay, I can also tell you that we've already arranged to meet with the Chief Rabbi of Poland, Rabbi Michael Shudrich. We've also already arranged to meet, we're in the process, I should say, of trying to arrange to meet with young Jews in Warsaw. Anya is going to be taking a lead role in that and contacting the Moshe House in Warsaw, and hopefully we'll have dinner together with them. I'm also in the middle of trying to arrange a meeting at the Jagiellonian University, which is a university founded in medieval times in Krakow. Copernicus went there, just to give you a sense of things. The Jagiellonian University has a Jewish studies department. Most of the people studying there are not Jewish. I'm trying to arrange for us to have a meeting with them. So hopefully we'll be able to have all of those meetings, and it'll give us a much better sense of the contemporary Polish Jewish community and the place of Jews in Poland in the contemporary period. Okay? Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.